Tantra Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Modern Monsters by Kelly York, narrated by Alex Mortensen. Chapter 1. Aaron Biggs leans over me to ask, "How's it going, Vic?" His freckled face and dyed black hair obscure my light. I squint at the page of algebra equations on the cafeteria table, decide they aren't going to make any more sense to me whether or not I pause to see what Aaron wants, and look up at him. Fine. Super, he flashes me a grin. My brother and his buddies rented out a cabin on the lake for a party this Friday. He said it would be cool if I invited a few people. I'm used to playing receptionist. This invitation is not meant for me, but for my best friend, Brett. I am not important. I am tolerated by association. I am Vic Howard, Brett Mason's best friend, so while people don't always care to learn anything about me, they do recognize my face. Being cool to me, they seem to think, is a way to stay cool with Brett. At least Aaron knows my name instead of referring to me as, "Hey, you." Of course, that's only because his mom and my mom are also best friends. Aaron doesn't leave until I've written down his information, address of the party, phone number, and time. He stresses that there will be booze, food, and girls. Plenty of girls. College girls, even. The idea makes my throat dry. I can hardly talk to a girl my own age, let alone one older than me and with undoubtedly a great deal more life experience. It's Wednesday, meaning I don't even see Brett until tennis practice after school. This also means I'm parking my butt on the bleachers outside the tennis courts and watching for the next 2 hours while Brett and a handful of others knock balls back and forth while wearing shorts that are way too short for my comfort. When they're done, Brett slips through the gate, mopping sweat off his forehead and grinning my way. Yo! Sometimes when I look at Brett, I still see the chubby, pimple-faced kid with braces and glasses whom I befriended in third grade. Maybe that's why he doesn't impress or intimidate me the way he does everyone else. I knew him back when nobody else wanted to. Party invite, I say, short and to the point. Even though Brett has never made fun of my stutter, it's habit to keep sentences short. I hand him the information I took down. Brett takes it and skims it over. The lake, huh? Could be fun. Do you want to go? The invite was for you. And you, by extension. I'm not going if you aren't going. He crams the paper into his duffel bag. Parties aren't my thing. More often than not, I end up being the loser sitting on the couch and watching Brett mingle and make new friends. Not that I'd want him clinging to my side the whole time, that'd be even lamer, but still, knowing he likes me to tag along is what convinces me to go to his social outings. No one else may care that I'm around, but Brett does. Maybe. Brett plops himself down beside me. Do you have other plans? He always gets me there. I might. You don't. He laughs. Come on, it's something different, yeah? Not some lame kegger while so-and-so's parents are out of town where we'll get yelled at for breathing on anything. It is something different, except I don't like different. Brett nudges me with an elbow once, then again when I roll my eyes and I don't answer right away, and a third time, until, fine, I'll go. That's my boy. He claps me on the back, shoulders his duffel bag, and jerks his chin toward the parking lot. Now let's get out of here. Friday after school, Brett and I head to his place, so he can get showered and dressed, all while lecturing me about the importance of wearing something nice, and at least run a brush through your damned hair, Vic, because my dark curls look unruly no matter what I try. Then we swing by my house so I can drop off my stuff and get changed. We're planning on grabbing a bite to eat on our way to the lake. I'm thinking the combination of a bunch of drunk people in a large body of water is a really bad idea. But what do I know? Don't be a buzzkill, Brett would say. Mom is in the kitchen nursing a cup of coffee. As I'm heading out the door, I stop to tell her, going to the movies and I'm staying at Brett's tonight. Be home tomorrow. This is more of a formality than anything. Mom doesn't care where I am, if I say I'm with Brett. She assumes anyone with a 4.0 grade point average must be a good kid, a good influence. Since it's just Mom and me, and she doesn't really care what I do as long as she thinks I'm not getting into trouble, I pretty much have free rein to do whatever. Mom halfway twists around to smile vacantly.
That's good. Tell him I said hello.
No further questions. Not that I expected any. Brett is outside honking, so I leave without a goodbye. Not counting the hour-long stop for dinner and a restaurant, the trip only takes about 40 minutes. There are something close to 30 cars crammed haphazardly together outside the lake house already, because Brad insisted on showing up fashionably late. Everyone else has probably been here a good hour or two. Brett parks close to the end where it isn't as crowded. Even from here I can make out the sound of music blaring, along with the shouts and cheers of people splashing around in the lake on the far side of the house. I should not have eaten that greasy cheeseburger and fries at the diner, because my stomach is in knots. The lake houses are two stories separated by a stretch of beach, so the noise from a party isn't likely to bother the neighbors. I looked this place up online last night. I like having a good idea what I'm getting into before an outing. So I know they're pricey rentals. I know it has 4 guest rooms upstairs, 2 bathrooms, its own kitchen, and a hot tub out back. Shrubs line the walkway to the front door. Brett leads me inside. It's one of the rare instances where I get to see him out of his element, because here he isn't Mr. Popular with everyone. Yet we'll see what happens by the end of the night. Out of the sea of faces, I recognize maybe half. The rest must be friends of Aaron's big brother, students of the local colleges. The people who are familiar to me aren't people I've ever talked to much anyway. Nearly everyone in the immediate vicinity is older than us, with the exception of Aaron, who just so happens to be making his way over from beside the patio doors with 2 plastic cups in hand.
Glad you could make it.
He shoves a beer into Brett's hand and 1 into mine. Got food in the kitchen with the keg. There's a chick in there mixing drinks, too. Brett doesn't smile, but he looks around with an appraising nod that suggests he approves. He leaves my side and drapes his free arm around Aaron's shoulders, despite being a good 3 inches shorter, and casts a look my way as though to ask if I'm coming. I don't particularly care for Aaron, nor do I want to trail on Brett's heels all night, so I shake my head mutely. Brett shrugs and they drift away from me. Brett is saying, "Why don't you introduce me to a few people?" I give it 20 minutes before he's either making out with someone or getting into deep conversations about the merits of whatever college these people go to versus some of the colleges on his, or rather his dad's, wish list. Where does that leave me? Standing just inside the front door with a beer in my hand. I hate beer. It tastes like battery acid. Not that I've ever tasted battery acid, but it's what I suspect battery acid would taste like. I try a sip anyway, like maybe I've forgotten and tricked myself into thinking it tastes horrible. Nope, still battery acid. I don't want to abandon my cup just yet, so I wander through the house, observing the various clusters of people talking, dancing, shoving their tongues in each other's mouths, mingling, having fun, everything I am not a part of. I'm in my own little bubble, unacknowledged by everyone. In the kitchen, I discreetly dump my beer out in the sink and toss the cup into the trash. Before I can get far, someone spots me drinkless and shoves another red plastic cup into my hand. At least this one doesn't smell like piss in plastic. I'm pretty sure this drink consists of orange juice and vodka, with a little umbrella poking out to make it look fancier than it is. The throng of people and this steady rumble of various conversations going on at once is making me claustrophobic. I make my way out back, which is much better. The air is cool and sharp and smells of water and sand. Paper lanterns hang from the trees, providing a dim but helpful glow to the stretch of rocky beach the house rests on. There's no sign of Brett, which means he's still inside somewhere. I don't really care about finding him just yet. As long as he's having fun, then whatever. I'm not going to be the dude who puppies around after his best friend because he can't function socially on his own. If that means sitting here until he comes looking for me, cool. That's sort of how these things go. Brett wants me to come with him, even in groups, but I never know how to interact. We've gone to the movies, bowling alleys, laser tag, arcades, and just hanging out at Brett's place with his friends from school or his tennis group. Some of them are nice enough guys. I just prefer to keep to the sidelines, out of the way. My drink stays in hand while I people watch. I spot Aaron's brother stripped down to his boxers, conversing loudly with a handful of people with lake water lapping at their legs. One guy I remember seeing at school floats around on a pink raft.
tethered to the shore so he doesn't drunkenly drift away. A couple near the back door are arguing. By some miracle, despite their slurred speech, they're being quiet enough not to attract too much attention. A girl behind me is thrown up in the bushes. My stomach rolls in sympathetic nausea at the sound of her heaving. A quick look around tells me that either none of her friends are here, or they don't care that she's spewing her guts all by herself. I weigh my options. Go inside and pretend I didn't see anything, or help her before she falls over and passes out. Possibly in the same bushes she's getting sick on. In the end, it isn't really a question. Maybe I'd like to turn my head the other way, but I'm already setting my drink down and coming up behind where the girl is bent over, hands on her knees, long blonde hair, a tangled mess around her face. She's taking small breaths, shallow and quick, and whimpering. I squint. Now that I'm getting a better look, I recognize her from school. Callie? Callie Wheeler moved to town in the middle of last year. I knew her only because Brett and I have both shared classes with her at some point or another. She jerks her head around in my direction so fast she nearly falls over, and I catch her by the elbows. Her gaze floats across my face. She's probably trying to place my name. Most people don't pay enough attention to know it. Just as she opens her mouth to say something, I see the color drain from her face. I help turn her back around just in time for her to throw up again, and I rub awkward circles across her back, unsure what else to do. Only when she's done does she straighten up and slump against me. I hold onto her arm and place the other hand on her hip to turn her around to head for the house. Such is the joy of getting here late, everyone else is already plastered. Callie wobbles on her feet, eyes closed to slits, so small I doubt she can see where she's going.
"Who are you again?"
she mumbles. I have to hold onto her waist to make sure she doesn't stumble coming over the threshold of the back door.
Vic Howard.
Why do I feel the need to make it a question? As though I'm asking, I'm Vic, is that okay?
I'm a friend of Brett Mason's.
We've had classes together.
Oh,
says Callie. And her eyelids droop and then close as we reach the steps that lead to the second floor. I'm left to holler up them one at a time because she isn't lifting her feet much. Given we aren't in someone's permanent home, I'm not worried about which room I take her to. I figure the first bedroom I come to on the left will do fine. Callie groans as I lay her down on the bed, on her side, in case she throws up again, and tug over a small wastebasket in hopes that she'll use it instead of, say, the floor. I lift her legs up onto the mattress. When I straighten up to pull away, she paws in my arm.
Don't call my dad. I won't, I promise. But I'm going to leave you here, okay? Try to sleep.
Callie rolls her red and blurry eyes up to look at me. She manages a smile before shifting further onto her stomach, flopping her head against the pillow and passing out almost instantly. She's going to be in for it with her parents if she stays here all night, I'll bet, but that isn't my problem. She's safe and she's comfortable. I've done my part. Heading back to the party, I stop halfway down the stairs where I have a better view of the people lingering in the living room and near the back door. Callie isn't the only one passed out. The couch is occupied by a couple pawing at each other and a guy slouched back against the cushions, surrounded in plastic cups like he came here for no purpose other than to get as drunk as he could as fast as he could. I'm searching for anyone who might go to my school and who might be a friend of Callie's so I can let them know to check on her. I see plenty of people I know, but I don't remember seeing Callie ever hanging out with any of them. Hell, even if I did spot one of her friends, I probably wouldn't know it. I see Chris Christopher, yeah, that's really his name, passing a joint around to Helen Barkley and Robbie Curtis. Patrick Maloney, one of Aaron's best friends, bumps into me as I come down the stairs while he's going up, along with Eric and Jacob. Probably in search of a free bathroom or something, or to scope out the rooms to bring girls to later. Nobody looks twice at me. The smell of weed is so strong at the bottom of the stairs that it almost makes me gag. I don't feel much like going out back again, so I wade through the crowd to the front door and squeeze outside. It's amazing how much quieter it is from the front porch. The party is a world away, nothing but distant sounds of splashing and shouting, and I try to decide if there's something wrong with me that I'm incapable of mingling and having a good time like everyone else here. Like Brett, I've never lived it up at a party. I've never hooked up with a girl. I've never gotten so drunk that I threw up in the bushes.
Given how much fun everyone seems to be having, am I missing out?
We got here 2 hours ago. Brett could be out in 10 minutes or 5 hours. There's never any telling with him. It depends entirely on if he found something to entertain him, a conversation he enjoys or a girl he can flirt with. I have little else to do but utilize the abundance of games on my phone to entertain myself. It's another 2 hours before Brett texts me.
You okay? Where are you?
I respond, and in a few moments he emerges from the house with a smile. He's been drinking, but Brett never gets sloppy drunk, just happy drunk. Kudos to him. He tosses me his car keys.
Ready to get going?
They hit my knuckles and then the ground when I attempt to catch them.
Yeah, meet anyone?
Nobody worth calling later. Brett crams his hands into his pockets and heads for the car. I grab the keys from the dirt and follow. Driving is always exciting. I've had my license for a year, but Mom doesn't have enough money to help me buy a car. And even after saving all summer, I'd only ended up with enough cash for something I'd be humiliated to be seen in. Getting behind the wheel of Brett's semi-new hybrid is always awesome. Although I had planned to stay at his place, he informs me that he has things to do bright and early in the morning, so we might as well drop me off at my house. While Brett dozes in the passenger seat, I focus on getting us home in one piece, letting my mind wander. This is my car. I'm driving home from a party I was invited to, not because of who my best friend is, but because people wanted me there. I have the windows down and my sunglasses on, smiling at anyone we meet because I'm not self-conscious that my hair is a mess or I'm too tall, too skinny, too dorky, or too not worth looking twice at. When I get home, I'll have a bunch of texts waiting for me. Thanks for coming tonight, man, and it was great meeting you. Let's hang out next weekend. It's a common daydream of mine, one that ends when I pull up outside my house and Brett opens the door and circles around to the driver's side as I'm stepping out. My fingers curl around the keys.
You sure you should be driving yet?
Dude, give me the keys. I'm good. I'll text when I get home to let you know I made it in one piece, yeah? He pries them out of my hand, claps me on the back, and gets into the car. I'll see you Monday. Then he drives away, and I'm left feeling, not for the first time, that this is what the world has in store for me. Being someone's stupid, stuttering shadow, the designated driver. All of this is someone else's life. I'm just along for the ride. Callie is a nagging concern in the back of my brain all weekend. Did she get home okay? Was she in trouble with her parents? How hungover was she the next morning? Does she even remember that someone helped her up to her room? I have no idea where she lives, so riding my bike past her house isn't an option. Instead, I have to wait for Monday. Second period, I work as an assistant in the front office. It isn't hard to take a quick peek at the locker assignments to tell where I'm likely to find her between classes. Brett meets me in the hall, and on our way to the cafeteria for lunch, I tell him I want to make a detour. He gives me a quizzical look, but goes along without question. My eyes scan the crowded hall for locker numbers, and when I come across Callie's, I slow down but don't stop. There's no sign of her. Maybe she doesn't go to her locker between classes. Some people keep all their books with them. As we walk away, I notice someone who isn't Callie approach Callie's locker. She's about Callie's height, but with longer, darker hair. She messes with Callie's combination lock, pops it open, and begins clearing things out. Not just books, but clothing, makeup, and miscellaneous junk. I stop in my tracks, frowning. Why would she do that? Brett shoves a finger into my ribs. Hello, Earth to Victor, are we going to get lunch or what? Lunch, right. I turn my gaze ahead and force my feet to move. Worst case scenarios are running through my head. Did something happen to her? Alcohol poisoning? Choked on her own vomit? Her parents were so mad they cut her up and stuck her in the freezer? Guilt is gnawing its way up my insides. If something happened to her, will it be my fault? What was that about? Brett asks.
Nothing. Just looking for someone.
What happened to Callie?
Chapter 2. Brett drops me off at home right after school, citing some college applications to fill out and email.
Fair enough.
I have a test to study for, and my studying time takes about 5 hours longer than the average person. If I'm lucky, I'll retain a quarter of the information I'm trying to cram into my tiny brain. Times like this, when I'm on my bed hunched over books, index cards, and notes, make me wonder what it's like to be in Brett's head. He's always been a brain, and his parents have pushed and pushed him to be brilliant. But I've worked hard for it, too, and I have always come up short. I don't know what it is. I've tried different methods of studying, but staying focused is impossible. By the time I finish reading chapters 6 and 7 in my history book, I've forgotten most of it, and I have to go back and reread them a second, third, and sometimes even a fourth time. Writing notes helps, but only a little. The sound of the television in the living room is distracting, echoing down the hall. For that matter, so is the knocking. Knocking? Oh, the front door. I pause, listening. Mom's footsteps, answering the door and saying worriedly, "Hello, is everything okay?" There's an undercurrent to her voice that draws me from bed to poke my head into the hall. Beyond Mom stand 2 police officers, a man and a woman, and their eyes immediately move from her to me. "We're looking for Victor Howard. Is he home?" the lady asks. "Victor is..." Mom turns, eyes wide and worried as she looks at me. "He's right there. What's going on? What is this about?" The male responds, "Just have a few questions for him is all." It takes effort to force myself slowly out of my room and down the hall. My chest is tight.
I'm Vic.
Stupidly offer my hand out to them, unsure what else to do. They glance at each other. Neither of them takes my hand. "I'm Detective Sherrigan, and this is Detective Carter, Waverly Police Department," the man says. "We came to ask you about a party you were seen at Friday night." My insides are mush and my legs are jelly. I slowly lower my hand, watching Mom from my peripheral. As she steps aside to let the officers in and shut the door, her eyes are so wide that I'm expecting them to fall out of her head. Oh, the explaining I'm going to have to do after this will be amazing.
"Okay,"
I say, wringing my hands together.
I was there.
Sherrigan writes this down in his notepad. Carter remains poised, hands folded in front of her, an expression grim.
"Do you know a Callie Wheeler?"
My spine stiffens.
"Is she okay?"
"Is that a yes?"
Yes, I know her. Sort of.
While Sherrigan is portly and looks like he'd be a nice guy on any other day of the week, Carter is the sort of cop you don't want to mess with. Short, hair pulled back into a serious bun, ruby red lipstick that makes her look like she just tore out the throat of her enemies with her teeth. She doesn't look impressed by me in the least. "Care to tell us what happened with Callie at the party that night?"
"I was at the party and she was... throwing up outside."
The words are coming harder, catching in my throat, tripping over my tongue. My hands are cold, clammy, made worse by my inability to get the words out as quickly as I want to. I can picture them in my head, but they're getting lost somewhere in translation.
So I spit it out, son,
Carter says. I breathe deeply, try to start over, one sentence at a time.
"I took her upstairs because she was drunk, put her to bed, and that was it.
I look between the two of them, increasingly unsure if honesty is the best response right now.
"Is she okay?"
"No, Victor, she's not." Carter dips her chin and peers over the top of her sunglasses. "She was raped."
"Raped?"
I repeat, because the word doesn't have any meaning right away. It takes a second to process it, to digest it, comprehend its meaning. Rape, any act of sexual intercourse that is forced upon a person. The word flow stops altogether. I stare dumbly at the detectives. I should have stayed with her.
I should have done something more than what I did. I had just thought she would be safe there in that room. I'm afraid I don't follow.
Mom's voice is a few octaves higher than usual. It happens when she's anxious. Is that all you came to ask him? Obviously, he doesn't know anything about this. Sherrigan turns to her, but I don't think his eyes ever really leave me. Ma'am, your son is being accused of raping Callie Wheeler. Gravity has suddenly gotten a very strong hold on me. I don't move for fear that it's going to yank me right to the floor and swallow me whole. Maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing. I could do with disappearing right about now. There are three sets of eyes on me, all questioning, all waiting for me to say something. I wait for Mom to come to my defense. Victor, no, he'd never do anything like that. Instead, she's staring at me with an expression I don't think I've ever seen on her face before. Some concoction of disgust, confusion, and horror. This is a dream, a nightmare. It's so stupid that I have to force myself to say, I didn't do anything. Carter asks, would you be willing to come down to the station to give a statement and submit to an exam? My insides are twisting, melting, knotting into an incomprehensible mess. I just told you what I know, which was effectively nothing. Callie was fine when I left her. And then she wasn't. Sherrigan and Carter continue to stare at me, not saying a word, but clearly unwilling to take no for an answer. I look at Mom helplessly, and she keeps her eyes averted, mouth screwed into a firm look of disgust. I just want her to reassure them that I wouldn't do this, that I'm her son, and I'm not perfect, but I'm an okay kid, and she knows me better than that. And yet, nothing. The vision of her standing there not helping me begins to blur as my eyes water. If being questioned clears my name, then why not? I don't know exactly what more I can say to them, but if it helps, if maybe something I say can lead them to really hurt Callie, I'll go. The next hour slithers by in a blur. I'm a minor, which means Mom has to come with me, and yet I find myself being placed in the back of Carter's car while Mom follows behind us in her car. Why? To keep me from talking to her? I'm too afraid to ask questions. What if it makes me look guilty? I have a right to an attorney, Sherrigan tells me when we arrive at a small clinic 20 minutes from home. I nod at this because I'm supposed to acknowledge it, but it still doesn't feel real. Mom lingers by her car. I see Carter approach her and speak, to which Mom shakes her head and murmurs something urgently to her, while the look on her face makes my heart sink. Carter walks away, leaving Mom to get back into her car. She isn't coming in. Maybe it's stupid for me to be surprised. Mom hasn't been there for me in years. So like many other things, I'm going into this blind and alone. Nothing comes back into focus until I'm seated on an exam room table in my boxers, and a flimsy hospital gown, and left by myself for a few minutes. Deep breaths. I wish Mom would have come with me. I wish my dad were a presence in my life instead of a one-night stand of Mom 17 years ago. I wish I could call Brett. I wish I had left Callie to throw up in the bushes by herself. No, better yet, I wish I had never gone to that stupid party to begin with. I should have told Aaron to go screw himself. I hear Sherrigan's voice outside my room speaking to someone else. No matter how hard I strain, I catch only glimpses of the conversation. Never saw his face. More than 72 hours. Victim said she recognized. They're talking about Callie and me. I squeeze my eyes shut. I don't want to hear any more. When Sherrigan finally comes back into my room, it's with the female nurse at his side. She's almost as tall as he is, and her smile is guarded, but not unfriendly. Hello, Victor. I'm Rosie. She already knows my name, and I'm not sure my tongue is going to cooperate with me, so I just wring my hands between my knees and nod. Rosie asks, do you know where you are? There's a lump in my throat. I swallow it. A doctor's office? Well, yes.
She pulls over her spinny stool and has a seat.
To be specific, this is the Sacramento RTC. We deal specifically with rape victims and occasionally suspects. Is this where they brought Callie, then? Did they shove her into one of these uncomfortable gowns and subject her to being prodded at? My chest constricts at the thought. How does someone even begin to process being violated and then having to spread her legs to let a doctor...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?